is a previously broadcast program.
There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing on. There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Wednesday edition of Off the Hour, right here on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are 15 days into the month of July. We are broadcasting from unceded Mohawk and Anishinaabe territory. You are tuned into The Avalanche, a special presentation of CKUT's Community News Department. The Avalanche seeks to cover issues affecting those with disabilities. I'm your host, Zoe. On today's show, an interview with Stephen LaPierriere from Replique on the state of mobility aid repair services and the inaccessibility of terraces. Then, audio from COVID-19 and the perils of warehousing people with disabilities, held by the McGill University Institute for Health and Social Policy. All that on CKUT 90.3 FM. You are listening to The Avalanche, where all abilities are welcome. If you'd like to get involved, you can call 514-448-4041, extension 6788, or email news at ckut.ca. Or you can follow us on Twitter at @AvalancheCKUT.
We'll be right back.
back to The Avalanche on CKUT 90.3 FM. For today's show, we speak with Stephen Lapierre from Replique on the state of mobility aid repair services in Quebec and the inaccessibility of terraces. Okay, so hi, Stephen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Would you be able to describe your organization and what you do within it?
Yes, the organization is REPLIQUE, which stands for Regroupement des Activistes pour l'Inclusion au Québec. And what we do is we promote the rights of the handicapped persons, and we also accompany them and offer assistance when they are a victim of discrimination towards the different institutions, Commission des droits de la personne et de la jeunesse, Commission canadienne des droits de la personne. So that's a little bit, that's our mission. That's our mission. We do more than that, but that's our main mission.
So you recently penned an open letter on your Facebook page. What is this letter about?
Well, this letter is about one of our members. Actually, it's about our treasurer, Laurent Morissette, who last Friday night had a problem with his electric wheelchair. The problem was the bottom plate of where he sits broke down, which meant that he could not he was not able to sit on his wheelchair. So the only other option he had was to have someone transfer him to his bed when that happened. And he phoned the Urgence Dépannage, which is a service that offers small urgent repairs on your wheelchair. But when it becomes a major issue like Laurent is, they're not able to fix that. So he placed this call on Friday night, but the service being what it is, the service doesn't start before noon the following day when it's weekend and holidays. So he had to wait at least until noon to get someone to come and see him, and only to be told that there was absolutely no way that he could repair his wheelchair on an emergency call. So the net result of that was that Mr. Morissette had to stay in his bed all day and all weekend until Monday morning, where he was able to go to the repair shop and get his wheelchair fixed. So our point on that particular issue is the following: if you have a car accident, there is always a Canadian Tire garage that's open that can fix you up, whether it's Saturday or Sunday or on holidays. If you have something with your animals, you know, there's emergency services always everywhere, all through the province. So you can take your pet there and have it taken care of. But if you're a handicapped person and if your wheelchair breaks on a holiday or on a weekend, and if it happens at night, you're stuck waiting at least until noon the other day, the following day. And if you have something that's more, if you have something that's broken more than a flat tire or something very easy to fix, you're not going to get fixed until the next open days. So to us, it's clear discrimination, and that's what we're saying. And we're going along with that. We're getting experiences from people who have gotten a flat tire on their wheelchair and at night, and nobody could come and help them out. So if you're stuck in your wheelchair and you cannot walk and you cannot transfer yourself easily from a wheelchair to a chair or to a bed, what are you supposed to do? Mm-hmm. And especially if you're outside, if it's raining, or if you're stuck in the cold, in the snow. So that it's clearly a discrimination. It's clearly a discrimination towards the handicapped persons not to be able to have an emergency service available all through Quebec for them to feel more secure, and just like everybody else. And it's also a fact where if you know that you don't have that service, it's something that's always on your mind and may prevent you from going out and going out to have a social life or to work or whatever. So it's always a case where handicapped persons, the old saying goes, handicapped persons are second class citizens. But when you have issues like that in 2020, you're more like third or fourth class citizens because nobody else in this society has this kind of service.
And would you say that conditions were standard like this prior to the pandemic?
Oh, yeah, it's always been like that. We have stories coming out that happened like 3, 4, 5, 6 years ago and all through Quebec. And it's one thing in Montreal, but we know, and we always suspected, but we know that it's worse in the regions, because when you're in Saguenay-Lac-Saint-Jean, or if you're in Rivière-du-Loup, services are even harder to get. But at the same time, when something happens to you, you're a citizen. You should be entitled to have a fair service. And if you're telling me that you're going to get your service within 24 hours, that's one thing. But if you're to get your service like 2-3 days after the incident happened, I mean, what are you supposed to do if you're not able to be, if you're not able to transfer yourself, if you're not able to do anything else, you're going to stay in bed for 3 days? Who would accept that?
And how does one's location, for example, you mentioned something about smaller towns getting less access to service. How does that impact the urgency at which people are addressed?
The urgency resides in the fact that if you cannot do anything, you need service. So it's one thing. I mean, you could always call 911 wherever you are to get immediate help, but 911 will not be able to fix your wheelchair. So there has to be somewhere in the there has to be a some kind of protocol that allows everyone in every region to have an emergency number that they can call to get proper repairs done on their wheelchair fast, within 4, 5, 6 hours. And if they're not able to do their repairs within that time frame, at least have some kind of service where they can supply temporarily another functional wheelchair, so that the person can at least get home and move around and go for their errands or whatever. Because the net result of those issues is that if that happens, you're stuck home. There's nothing you can do. You cannot go do your errands. You cannot do anything else but rely on other people. And if you're, as is the case, isolated person, because when you're handicapped persons, often there's not that many people around you, so you found yourself even more so excluded from society. So that's where the emergency lays. I mean, if I was to cut your legs and say, oh, okay, you're going to stay home for 3 days doing nothing, well, it wouldn't make sense. Well, when something like that happens, when a wheelchair breaks, it's the legs of the person that uses the wheelchair that are broken. And nobody would accept to stay home 3 days because something is broken, right?
Regarding the regional aspect, is there a difference between the way that, for example, a caller from Montreal would be addressed versus a caller in the Eastern Townships? How is this resource dispatched?
Well, there's a timing issue, not a timing issue, but a distance issue. I know that there are some, let me put it this way, repair depots in regions. But if you happen to live very far from that depot, it takes even more longer. And some of those resources, I think they're not opened on Sunday. That had to be verified. But still, it's still harder to get access to those services when you're in further regions.
So if someone were to place a call, let's say Friday night, what would the process be of them getting help?
You'd place your call on Friday night, and the emergency services start at noon on Saturday and Sundays. So somebody would come and visit you on Saturday afternoon, and would try to fix what the problem is, but it still has to be a minor problem. If it's a seat problem, if it's an electrical problem, or another another problem that a wheelchair might have, then you might not be able to have your the technician fix the wheelchair, and you're still stuck home for the weekend.
And how do you feel the pandemic has impacted this service?
Well, we know that during the pandemic, the only services that were offered were emergency services. So we're pretty sure that there were some issues with some people with heavier problems with their wheelchairs, but they have not been reported to us so far. But we know that the repair centers, of course, during the pandemic, they were closed. And they only did emergency services at home, and now it's starting to reopen again, like everything else. So we'll see how that works out. But for sure, during the pandemic, it was tougher to get services if you had a bigger problem with your wheelchair.
And what kind of stories have you been hearing so far with the submissions that have come your way?
Well, we've heard of someone, like I was explaining earlier, to someone getting like a flat tire at night around 11 o'clock, and it was in Saguenay, Lac Saint-Jean. And they had, and fortunately that night, the person that was with the person that was that is handicapped was able to transfer him into a taxi. They were able to get to their hotel. But there again, they were not able to get his wheelchair fixed before 5 or 6 o'clock the next day. So that really puts a burden on a getaway weekend. So it's stories like that. People that are stuck home because their wheelchair is not moving because there is an electrical problem. And there again, it happens at night, so you get the technician the following day and he's not able to repair it, because that's more than the emergency service can do.
And do you feel that this problem is unique to Quebec, or is it seen in other provinces within Canada?
I can only really talk about Quebec. The other provinces, I would not advance myself to say that, because we're not 100% sure. But we would have reasons to believe that at least in areas that are outside the major cities or larger cities, the situation is probably the same.
And what steps can be taken to improve these services?
What people need to realize is that handicapped persons really have a life. They have obligations. They have family. So the steps that needs to be taken are emergency repair service have to be faster to reply, first of all. I mean, to me, it makes no sense that the service starts only at noon. So that's one thing that has to be changed. And the other thing, the technicians that come home have to be able to have more equipment, more knowledge, and more tools in order to fix on-site the wheelchair. And if worse comes to worst, if you cannot fix it, and it happens, you need to be able to have to supply another wheelchair, at least for the time that the wheelchair will be fixed.
So in your letter, you mentioned Minister Christian Dubé specifically. What would the involvement of the minister do?
Because one thing we learned with the pandemic is that handicapped persons are always evacuated from the public discussions. I mean, you've barely heard our politicians talk about handicapped persons during this whole pandemic. We feel that this situation that we're talking about, emergency repairs during weekends or holidays, nobody knows about that. It's not understood. It's not been talked about. And we're pretty sure that our politicians don't know about it either. So we're trying to raise Mr. Dubé's attention, since he is new at the Minister of Health, to catch his attention, to say, hey, something's wrong here and it needs fixing, and it needs fixing now. So the idea behind this is to tell him the stories that happen, because they do happen, and to help us out get a better service and more money if necessary for those repair shops to operate better and offer a proper service to handicapped persons.
And do you feel that this issue should also be addressed federally?
Well, actually, the wheelchairs that are supplied are, for most of them, if not all, are supplied by the government of Quebec, through the Régie de l'Assurance Maladie du Québec. The problems have to be addressed there. I don't think it's a federal issue at that level.
And what about on the municipal level?
On the municipal level, again, it's really a provincial issue, because those wheelchairs are the responsibility of Quebec. I'm sure that if there would one thing the cities could do is probably have some kind of depot available to those repair stores if necessary, to have spare wheelchairs or something like that. I'm sure the city could help, and I'm sure the city would help if they were requested. But again, for us, it's an issue that has to go through the hands of the provincial government if those repair services don't do the proper improvements to their services.
Going back to the city, you guys recently published a video talking about the inaccessibility of terraces.
Yes.
Would you be able to describe this video to us?
Yes, absolutely. We have two of our members, Laurent Morissette and Martin Dion. They went all through the main center quarters of Montreal to see how are the terraces, if they're accessible, if there's a possibility to get service for handicapped persons, and we do that year after year, but this year it's very particular because of the pandemic. The city has allowed the terraces to be bigger, wider, more seats, and that's all fine. We're not against that. Obviously, businesses have to survive, and we're all for that. But it was done fast. It was done very, very in a way that was unplanned. And permits for terraces were handed out business to business owners. The universal accessibility was not taken care or what?
In response to the pandemic, and though the federal government has appointed a COVID-19 disability advisory group to provide policy guidance on issues related to the pandemic, none of the provinces has included disability activists in their pandemic response teams, and that's especially apparent in Quebec. The pandemic has both highlighted and worsened the problems of warehousing people in institutions that we've known about for 60 years, since the exposure of conditions at the Huronia Regional Center in Orillia, Ontario in 1960. And Jonathan is going to talk about that, so I'm just going to skip right down to the next section. Other problems related to the COVID-19 policies that have been implemented since the beginning of the pandemic. One of the policies that has been implemented, especially in Quebec, has been to increase wages for institutional employees to make up for staff shortage. But that has lured workers away from providing home-based care, and that has created its own problem. Proprietary software and digital locks make it difficult to repair or adapt ventilators and other essential medical equipment. People whose health deteriorates due to poor quality care, such as insufficient time to eat or poor wound care, are often placed on palliative care regimes where food and water and other medical treatments are withdrawn whether or not they have COVID-19. And so basically a lot of people are left to die that way. And medical assistance in dying, which is classified as an elective procedure, continue to pay despite the suspension of other elective procedures. The United Nations and Government of Canada each released policy statements on COVID-19 and disabled people. The UN document emphasized the rights of disabled people and suggests specific actions regarding healthcare, people in institutions, community living, income and employment, education, domestic violence, homeless people, and prisoners with disabilities. The Government of Canada's recommendations focus on support for vulnerable populations and are not very substantive. Ontario and Quebec issued triage policies which drew fire from disability rights organizations for lack of computer consumer input in their development and because the protocols violated principles of non-discrimination, such as those described in the evaluation framework for crisis plans developed by some disability organizations in the United States. Both the Ontario and Quebec procedure protocols mention specific disabilities such as cognitive impairments, Parkinson's disease, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, and cystic fibrosis as criteria for exclusion. While neither protocol uses quality of life measures per se, both use the clinical frailty scale as a measure of a person's overall health based on their ability to independently perform certain activities of daily living, which is a no-no. Both protocols use potential for long-term survival as threshold eligibility criteria, which puts people with chronic illnesses and disabilities at a disadvantage for getting treatment and fails to account for the significant surrounding long-term survival probabilities. And institutions have found a way to get around the triage protocols. Though officials assure the public that the worst case scenario that would invoke the triage policies won't happen. However, that policies are only invoked if there is a substantial strain on the healthcare system, but there is no strain on the system if nursing home residents with COVID-19 are not sent for aggressive treatment in intensive care unit. This is de facto triage by age and disability. And this is a really important point because, you know, they're assuring us, don't worry, these triage protocols won't be invoked, but the reason they're not invoked is because people are being left to die. However, there is hope in fighting back. Nobody is disposable is a coalition of queer, fat, disabled, and people of color who have challenged discriminatory policies and created educational material. The Black Lives Matter movement has amplified the voice of disabled people of color. Especially active in that is Anita Cameron with Not Dead Yet in the United States. She's the multicultural outreach coordinator. As they speak about the intersectional nature of racism and disability discrimination, and in response to criticism, the Ontario triage protocol, it was withdrawn but has not yet been replaced. Quebec's triage protocol is being challenged by advocates who have launched a petition asking for it to be withdrawn. And finally, communication and accessibility options have expanded through the adoption of more flexible employment practices, such as working from home and online meetings. So the isolation that disabled people live with all the time has now become the norm for everybody else.
Unmute. Okay, great. So thank you, Amy. So I'll put on the chat a link to a petition in relation to that Amy was talking about, so that those interested in signing the petition and getting more information, the petition being against the triage protocol in Quebec that could be problematic, it will be in the chat. Also, if you want to ask questions to everyone, yes, I will immediately, yeah. If you want to provide a question either privately to me or to the speakers or to me addressing the speaker, I'm taking notes of any question you may have, and we will have a question period immediately after the talks. And so the second speaker is Heidi Johns. Heidi, do you want to go? I'm going to pass it over to you.
Okay.
The COVID-19 pandemic has thus far been punctuated by reports of ableism in action. Of course, these events have almost never been reported on as instances of ableism. Rather, they've been presented as unfortunate consequences of healthcare systems being pushed beyond their breaking point by the pandemic. Among the most disturbing of these reports have been stories of COVID-19 outbreaks in long-term care facilities and group homes causing personal support workers and healthcare aides to fall ill themselves, and prompting those who remain to abandon their elderly and disabled clients. Interestingly, and tellingly, while the deplorable conditions of seniors languishing in long-term care facilities has, rightfully, garnered national attention in recent months, the abandonment of physically and developmentally disabled adults by staff at Participation House, a care home in Markham, Ontario, in April, was little more than a blip in the 24-hour news cycle. For both the mainstream media and the general public, there appears to be a clear qualitative distinction between the physically and developmentally disabled residents of Participation House and the, mostly, senior residents living in long-term
with COVID-19. All of these things point to the fact that Canada suffers from a pre-existing condition that is making COVID-19 much more lethal for entire segments of its population. The name of this condition is ableism. Disability scholar Veronica Chouinard defines ableism as ideas, practices, institutions, and social relations that presume able-bodiedness, and by so doing, construct persons with disabilities as marginalized and largely invisible others. Canadian disability scholar Gregor Wolbring notes that ableism and preference of certain abilities has been rampant throughout history. Ableism shaped and continues to shape areas such as human security, social cohesion, social policies, relationships among social groups, individuals, and countries. Ableism is one of the most societally entrenched and accepted isms. I find Professor Wolbring's summary of the all-encompassing scope of influence that ableism has in contemporary Western society to be quite accurate. Clear, yet unacknowledged, evidence of ableism can be seen in everything from the way in which buildings are built to exclude people who do not walk or see, to the way in which students with disabilities are taught that it's better to look, move, and behave as much like their non-disabled peers as possible, to the way in which terms associated with disability are used as insults in common parlance. Unlike sexism or racism, however, ableism remains a largely unacknowledged form of discrimination. Healthcare has traditionally been viewed as a benevolent discipline in which every human life is valued equally, without any form of prejudice or discrimination. While this may remain the ideal to which healthcare aspires, the reality is that, as individuals, healthcare professionals are not immune to the influence of dominant societal understandings of, and attitudes towards, individuals and groups of people deemed to be others. Gali and colleagues observe that despite their intentions, personal goals, and normative expectations, even health professionals are unconscious bearers of implicit social biases that affect the quality of professional interventions. They further contend that, immediately, and from early life and thereafter, people perceive individuals with disability as vulnerable and of low competence and, accordingly, treat members of this group differently. Despite the major role that medical professionals play in the lives of people with disabilities, research indicates that people with disabilities frequently encounter discrimination in healthcare settings, even in ordinary times. Studies have consistently shown that, as a group, healthcare professionals tend to substantially underestimate the quality of life of people with disabilities. Such erroneous judgments about the quality of life experienced by people with disabilities can result in treatment options for people with disabilities being either limited or altogether eliminated. At the heart of such decisions is what disability scholar Joel Reynolds has termed the ableist conflation of disability, suffering, and death, wherever operative. The ableist conflation flattens communication about disability to communication about pain, suffering, hardship, disadvantage, morbidity, and mortality. What makes medical ableism so dangerous and so insidious at the same time is that it often presents as common sense. James Cherney argues that ableism is that most insidious form of rhetoric that has become reified and so widely accepted as common sense that it denies its own rhetoricity, it goes without saying. Within this milieu of common sense ableism, people with disabilities are routinely made vulnerable in medical settings. For example, studies have consistently shown that the emergency department environment can be stressful, and even dangerous, for people with developmental disabilities and/or communication disabilities, both because deficits associated with these conditions hamper these individuals' ability to communicate their concerns, and because staff often do not have the skills needed to work with them. The advent of COVID-19 has only exacerbated these stresses and hazards, sometimes with lethal consequences. The tragic death of Arias Knight in April powerfully demonstrates the real and present danger that medical ableism poses for people with disabilities in the wake of COVID-19. Knight was a 40-year-old BC woman who had cerebral palsy. She was nonverbal, but could communicate with her family and aides through facial expressions, which they had learned to recognize and interpret. She died of a respiratory illness on April 18th. A few days after she was transferred to the hospital from the group home in South Surrey where she had lived for a decade. Because of COVID-19 visitor restrictions, none of Knight's caregivers or family members were allowed to be with her in the hospital, and she died alone. Even prior to COVID-19, many people with disabilities, especially those with communication disabilities, have been fearful of going into emergency because their support people may not be allowed to stay with them. Arias Knight's death, and the circumstances surrounding it, sparked an outcry from disability rights advocates across the country. The newly appointed Federal COVID-19 and Disability Advisory Group, CDAG, presented an urgent recommendation to the Federal Minister of Health that she strongly encourage her provincial and territorial counterparts to revise their hospital visitation policies so as to designate family members and support workers who provide care and assistance to a patient with disabilities as essential visitors. While the Federal Minister of Health did agree to take this recommendation forward to her provincial and territorial counterparts, to date, I have only been able to confirm that visitor policies have been amended to adopt this recommendation in British Columbia, Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Ontario. Although this may be an incomplete list, it nevertheless speaks to the fact that recognition of the right of people with disabilities to have access to their personal support people in medical settings during this COVID-19 pandemic remains far from being universally guaranteed across Canada. For the first 2.5 months of this pandemic, we heard our Prime Minister, Premiers, and officers of public health join in unison with their counterparts around the world to repeat the mantra, flatten the curve, protect the vulnerable, stay home. The optimists among us may have been tempted to point to this as a sign of a resurgence in the value that our society attributes to the lives of vulnerable seniors and people with disabilities. The extreme optimists among us may have even been tempted to wonder if the pandemic could possibly become a catalyst for the reclamation of the notion of a common good as the core ethic of our society. Ethicist John Rawls defined the common good as certain general conditions that are equally to everyone's advantage. Ironically, in the decades leading up to this current pandemic, the notion of the common good as a viable ethical principle had, for all intents and purposes, become obsolete due to the rise of autonomy as the cardinal ethical principle in Western societies. Yet, the advent of COVID-19 seemed to bring with it a renewed recognition of the viability, indeed, the necessity, of upholding the common good as a guiding ethical principle to ensure our survival as a society. Unfortunately, however, other developments we've seen during this pandemic sharply undercut such optimism. Early on in this pandemic, in many provinces across Canada, we saw the release of critical care triage protocols which provide guidance for the allocation of critical care resources, i.e. ventilators, should they become scarce due to an overwhelming surge in critically ill patients with COVID-19. As these protocols became public, it became evident that the vast majority of them listed pre-existing disability as an exclusion criterion in the event that rationing of critical care resources becomes necessary. Again, disability rights advocates across the country, as well as the CDAG, were quick and persevering in sounding the alarm regarding the blatantly discriminatory nature of these protocols, and the extreme danger that they pose for Canadians with disabilities. Again, these concerns were relayed from a federal to a provincial level. Unfortunately, while the response on the essential visitor policy has been inconsistent, the response on discriminatory critical care triage policies has been virtually non-existent. So, where does all this leave people with disabilities still in the midst of the pandemic? Unfortunately, I think that, to a great extent, the answer to this question is found in a distinction that I alluded to at the beginning of this presentation. That is, the distinction that both the mainstream media and the general public are making between seniors in long-term care facilities, who are regularly, collectively referred to as our parents, or our grandparents, versus younger adults with physical and/or developmental disabilities, who, although they are likewise warehoused in congregate care facilities, do not share the senior's status as once having been non-disabled, contributing members of society. People with disabilities thus continue in essentially the same position that we were in before the pandemic, on the margins of an ostensibly inclusive society.
Sorry, thank you so much, Heidi. So we'll move to our last speaker, Jonathan Marchand. I hand it over to you.
Thank you, Jonas. All right. So, all right, institutions, segregation, and the way forward. Now, I was introduced by Jonas.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called?
The news brought to you live.
That completes this episode of The Avalanche, a special edition of Off the Hour, airing every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. To stay up to date with The Avalanche news, check out our Twitter, at AvalancheCKUT. Again, that's at AvalancheCKUT. Thank yous are due to all those who make educational and inspirational radio here at CKUT possible. If you would like more information on anything you heard tonight, or would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact The Avalanche at avalancheckut.ca or CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 6788 or news at ckut.ca. Stay tuned for Hearsay. That's up next.
CKUT 90.3 FM, Montreal. vous écoutez CKUT 90 virgule 3 à Montréal.
Ok, oh, merci beaucoup.
If you're young at heart, for it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind. If you're young at heart, you can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams, and life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard you will find to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you'll derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young at heart.
Good evening and welcome to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3 in Montreal. We come to you monthly every second Wednesday. My name is Laura Yaris and I'll be your host today. We're going to rerun an interview this evening that I did last July with Professor Dr. Elaine Leader, who did some fascinating research and interviews with older Jewish women anarchists who were active between 1920 and 1950. It's an incredible body of work about these women, and I'm happy to bring it to you once again. We're going to wrap up the show with a conversation I had with our sister collective member, Rosemary Wally, about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, given that this Friday, December 10th, is International Human Rights Day. We'll have a little bit of music for you as well. But first, on behalf of the entire Older Women Live Collective, I would like to express our deepest condolences to our dear sister collective member, Marlène Rateau, who recently suffered a death in the family. Please know that you have our support, and may your family be spared further sorrow. And now let's get right into our rerun of Professor Elaine Leader. Here's a little background on Elaine Leader. She holds a master's degree in social work from Yeshiva University, a master's in public health from University of California at Berkeley, and a PhD from Cornell. She's a professor emerita of sociology and the dean emerita of the School of Social Sciences at Sonoma State University in California. Previously, she was a professor at Ithaca College in Ithaca, New York. She has over 40 years of distinguished accomplishments and experience in academia and public service. She's received numerous awards and grants and has published 5 books and numerous articles on various subjects. For example, her book, My Life with Lifers, Lessons for a Teacher, Humanity Has No Bars, describes her work at San Quentin State Prison and Elmira Correctional Facility. Currently, she does victim-offender dialogues in prisons across the state of California. She was born in Lynn, Massachusetts, to a working-class immigrant family. Her mother's family was from Poland, and her father got out of Lithuania in 1939, just as World War II was beginning. His family was killed in 1941 in their hometown of Kupiskis. Elaine believes that this incident has informed her identity in deep and profound ways. She's always been dedicated to understanding how people can harm others and what motivates them to do vicious things. She's been involved in promoting social justice in various ways all her life, first marching with Martin Luther King Jr. in Boston, engaging in civil rights activities, anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, women's rights movements, mental patients liberation, gay rights, Black Lives Matter, and now hashtag MeToo. She worked her way through college and graduate school and was able to overcome the socialization that would have had her become a homemaker, mother, and wife. She held those roles, and she was also a social worker, a psychotherapist from 1967 to 1992, when she worked in mental hospitals, gerontology, foster care, drug and alcohol counseling, and domestic violence as a therapist. And she's been a college professor from 1977 to today, and a writer since the early 70s, and an activist all her life. I recently became acquainted with her through a presentation she gave over Zoom for the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research. The topic was Jewish Women Anarchists between 1920 and 1950. I found her talk so interesting and exciting, I just had to contact her myself, and she graciously agreed to do the interview you're about to hear. So Professor Leader starts off by explaining how she came to interview these fascinating, colorful, and amazing women.
I was working on my PhD at Cornell in the 1980s when I was writing about Rose Pisoda, who was an anarchist labor organizer, one of the women I'll talk about later. And as a result of doing that book, I interviewed a bunch of older anarchist women, and I was so smitten with them. I just thought they had such fabulous stories that I went back after I finished the book, and I began in about 1986 to do the interviews because I'd gotten a grant from my college. And then later I was in an NEH seminar, National Endowment for the Humanities seminar on women called The History of Women Through Social Movements, and we were supposed to do oral histories, and I just went back and dug up the material I had done and interviewed a few more people. So I kind of finished this in 1996, and I tried to publish it, but nobody was really very interested, and I went on to other matters. And then all of a sudden there's a resurgence of interest in anarchism as an ideology and these women as examples of living their lives anarchistically. And so I called the work Anarchist Women 1920 to 1950, The Politics of Sexuality, because their behavior was really outside of the norm for people, for women of that generation. So that's how it all began.
We hear about Emma Goldman. She was an anarchist, and there's a lot of information about her, and she had a pretty colorful life and all that. But you named so many other anarchist women who we never heard of. And I mean, I'm really glad that there's some kind of resurgence or whatever, and that we can find out more about this. Are there any plans in the works now to get this work published?
I have been invited to give two papers. One will be a scholarly paper for a book out of University of Illinois on anarchist contemporary and historical perspectives on anarchism. And then there's an anarchist journal out of Oxford, England that's also interested. So I'm writing up the scholarly one, and then I'll write up the one for popular consumption later. But I'm really having a good time going back through the material because these women, may I tell you something about them?
Yes, absolutely. That was going to be my next question.
Okay.
Please.
Well, first of all, let me situate them in an era. Remember that I'm writing from 1920 to 1950, and this is after the Red Scare or during the Red Scare.
Yeah, really.
And so there was a lot of effort on the part of Americans to lay low, keep a low profile, not be too political. And it was also an era in which there were great expectations of what a woman should be. She should be a housewife, she should be a mother. If she wants to work, well, let her be a good housewife and mother first. And that was primarily, of course, for white middle class and upper class women. The women I studied were working class women. They worked as secretaries, they worked as seamstresses, and they were involved in activities that the mainstream were not involved in. They were, I'll tell you some of the details, but I kind of just want to situate them for you first.
Yeah.
They were all immigrants, and so English was not their first language. Yiddish was. They came to the United States in the teens, all expecting that, of course, the streets were paved with gold, as it was expected, but it wasn't. And many of them went to work in places where the conditions were pretty horrific. And so they were in sweatshops, they were in positions of being second-class citizens. One of them, Rose Pasota, the one that I did the biography on, actually got herself up to the position of vice president of the ILGWU, but she was the only woman on the board, and she was the only anarchist, and she was not heard. She was just marginalized. And so these women were living in an era, and I certainly remember it from my mother and from me growing up. It was kind of the expectations like you saw on the early shows of Mad Men. You know, very conventional kind of lifestyles. Women were supposed to be seen and not heard. Women were supposed to be good secretaries, but could never get to the position of CEO. And so these women rebelled. And they were need to be situated in their politics as well. They were anarchists. Now, most of us, when we hear the word, think that anarchists are chaos, bomb-throwing revolutionaries who just want a society that is a free-for-all. And that is very far from the truth. Anarchism has a really long, deep, rich philosophical political history. It goes back to Proudhon, Bakunin, Kropotkin, and these theorists, and even further back than that, really argued that there has to be ultimate freedom for all individuals, no matter what gender you happen to be. And most of the time, people argued that it had to come from the workplace. But many others talked about it in terms of individual relationships and the way that the power dynamics are operating in relationships. And so early anarchist thinkers were against marriage, because Emma Goldman wrote extensively on how women are victimized within marriage. They also believed in what was something that was called sexual varietism. And we might now call that non-monogamy or being polyamorous. But remember, this is the 1950s, 40s, and to be polyamorous and non-monogamous is sexual varietism, is pretty unusual. And there were other, you know, there were free lovers and there were free thinkers during that time, but they were a minority. And so these women that I interviewed have interesting stories, but it's in the context of having come out of oppressive family life in Europe. Most of them were raised Orthodox Jewish, and one of them, Clara, was never allowed to be educated until she came to the United States. Her family was, I think there were 12 children, and none of the girls were educated. All of the boys went to yeshiva and learned a great deal, but not Clara. And that was not uncommon in those days. That was also true for the other women that I interviewed. So we're talking about a period of time that they're coming out of great repression and victimization, and they gravitated to the ideology of anarchism, which is complete freedom and independence from other people. And there really is a sense that they wanted true liberation, and that meant complete equality between the sexes and complete equality in terms of economic independence. And they wanted that for women at a time when women were not completely independent economically, except for working class women. Many of the women that I interviewed were the sole breadwinners of their families because the men that they were partnered with, not always married, were engaged in political activity. Many of the men went to the Spanish Civil War to fight with Abraham Lincoln Brigade. They were involved in the IWW, the Industrial Workers of the World.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
You're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
It's time for Adios, Smith. It's time for Adios, Smith. Smith, 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 Smith. A queer, feminist, trans-positive radio show about fucking in all its forms.
Four, five fingers.
Let's not beat around the bush. This show contains explicit sexual content.
So turn the volume all the way up.
Oh, that was so hot. I'm gonna pee for you now. You ready? Yeah, you wanna watch me pee? Oh yeah, I'm gonna pee, yeah.
Adios,